and welcome to the seventh season of Scene to Song, a musical theater podcast for people who love to discuss, critique, and celebrate musicals as a literary art form. I'm your host, Shoshana Greenberg, and each episode I'll bring on a guest to talk about a musical, musical theater writer, or a topic or trend in musical theater. A little podcast update. After this episode, I'm going to switch to a monthly schedule instead of every 2 weeks, with the next episode coming out the first Monday in May. I won't take as big a summer break, though, so the episode count for the year should still be about the same. I'll see how this goes and either stick with it or go back to the previous release schedule. My guest today is Matt Koplik. Matt hosts the popular and long-winded theater podcast Broadway Breakdown. He's worked as an actor in plays such as the Drama Desk rejected Daddy Issues. He's also worked as a critic and playwright or screenwriter, and his newest play, Yours Truly, was recently named a semifinalist for the 2024 Terrence McNally New Works Incubator. He's frequented 54 Below and Chelsea Table and Stage as a guest singer. Follow his Instagram, Matt Koplik, and read his more unhinged yet possibly astute critical assessments of the Broadway season. We're going to talk today about Janine Tesori musicals. Hey, Matt, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you so much, Ashana. This is so much fun. Thank you.
Well, we will start, as we do, with our get-to-know-our-guest questions. And what was your first experience with a musical?
So the first Broadway show I ever saw was Beauty and the Beast. I was 4, and that was pretty memorable. I have a lot of images stuck in my brain from that. But I think the first experience I had with musicals in general was, I mean, it's still Disney, but like, you know, the Renaissance movies, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. I couldn't tell you which one was first. They all were just sort of playing all the time.
What is the last great musical you saw?
I saw Titanic for the 4th or 5th time back in January. So I would say that. But I guess like the last great musical I saw for the first time would be, I guess Kimberly Akimbo when they moved to Broadway, which was November of 2022. That was the last time I saw a musical and was like, yeah, you're great.
Well, it goes right in line with what we're going to be talking about soon. So that's
soon. Yes.
So that's good. What's a musical that people would be surprised to find out you love, and why would they be surprised?
I think people would be surprised to know that I love Mamma Mia. I think a lot of people assume that I have a pretty esoteric taste when it comes to musicals. My taste ranges all over the place. I go to Golden Age, I go to present day, you know, Gettle and Lacusa and all that stuff. And a lot of stuff that's come out on Broadway in the last few years has been underwhelming, in my opinion. And I think a lot of people assume I feel that way because they're just trying to be fun entertainments. And I'm like, no, because I love Mamma Mia. But I think something like Mamma Mia is actually really hard to do because it's so dumb, but it's so smart about how dumb it is. And I say, like, if you want me to turn off my brain, you got to do all the work for me. Mm. And I do think that Mamma Mia, she do the work. So I love it. And I think some people get surprised when I say that because they're like, aren't you the one who likes the Lacusa Wild Party? And I go, yeah, and?
What's your favorite musical that no one else has heard of?
If people are listening to this, who listen to the podcast, it's sort of a complicated answer because they all know this musical because I talk about it so much. But I would say the mass public of theater people don't know this musical, and that's Smile.
Mm.
Yeah, a musical from the 1980s based off of a 1970s film about a teenage beauty pageant in California. It has music by Marvin Hamlisch, who did a chorus line, and Howard Ashman did the lyrics and book. He did Little Shop of Horrors and many of the Disney films we love so much, and tragically passed away due to complications from AIDS in like 91, I think. Yeah. And it didn't run very long. And really, if people have heard of it, all they know is the big song Disneyland, but it is a phenomenal score. And the script that's out for licensing is actually really intelligent and a very biting satire on American culture and how we overly sexualize girls from a far too young age, and how like beauty pageants are this weird like show and pony, you know, show that's like just it's all very archaic and weird and like odd. And but they do it in a very fun theatery way. And yeah. I just love it. And not a lot of people know it. And those that do know it probably saw like a really bad high school production. So they're like, I don't know, this is a weird show. I was like, no. Like, give it to like Casey Nicola or Susan Stroman and they will show you what the show can be.
Who is your favorite hero character or protagonist in a musical? And who is your favorite villain or antagonist?
I don't love shows where a character is so like unapproachably perfect that they're aspirational. I like it when they're flawed and relatable. It's going back to the Renaissance Disney movies, it's why like I love Belle. She's aspirational, but Ariel is relatable. Like that girl is flawed. Belle has no flaws. But okay, so this may be like a controversial answer because it depends on who plays the part. And I know some people have complicated feelings about the show, but the character of the king in The King and I, I think is this phenomenal mystery while also being incredibly complex. This is the king of a country who has been told his entire life that his job was given to him by God, essentially, that no, he was destined for this, and that because he's king, everything he says and do is correct. And yet he's intelligent enough to know that there's a world outside of his kingdom, which is why he brings Anna in to teach his children. But having that intelligence also means that he's second guessing everything he's ever known about himself and what his country has told him, while also being like, but there are things that work here. So if I second guess that, is that, you know, is that me going against my legacy? It's a very similar thing to Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. Both are phenomenal characters where it's like, I don't know, we've made it this far doing things how they've been. But also, you know, if I say that I'm the learned man that I am, or if I'm the learned man that I say I am, like, I have to challenge myself. And it leads to a lot of turmoil. And I just love that. I think
It's like the whole, like, can I change or can we change?
And they both do, which I think is wonderful. And it's so rare in a musical to see a character change in a way that's really human and painful, just in the way that change can be. You know, we all have main character syndrome, so we all want to believe that we don't make mistakes, and if we do, it's because we've been led astray. It's like, no, sometimes you mess up and you hurt someone or you say the wrong thing. And when do you recognize that you're actually the villain in the story and work on you? But so that's a cheat. The King and Tevye, I think, are two phenomenal characters. Yeah. They have very similar storylines.
Yeah. And do you have a favorite antagonist?
Kinda. I guess I would say, this is such a weird one, but Curtis Taylor Jr. in Dreamgirls, because he starts the first half of that show actually having a mission that I understand. And then he does such a heel turn and to become just the villain of the show. So it's not really his fault so much as it's my fault with the show itself, where I'm just like, well, now you've just become a mustache twirling villain and you're just tanking other people's singles for, you know, no good reason. So that always has bugged me every time I've seen the show. But his first half of Act One is great.
Kind of moves from antagonist into villain, into like stereotypical villain.
Yeah, it's like right after Cadillac. It's somewhere between Cadillac Car and Family. He does this turn that I'm just like, okay, now you're cardboard cutout, but that's fine, I guess.
What is a moment in a musical that you think gets to a complex emotional state that you didn't think was possible to get to?
Oh, anyone who listens to my podcast is going to be like, of course you're bringing this one up. My favorite musical is Carousel. Again, controversial pick. And the bench scene is one of the greatest works of art ever written for musical theater. But primarily the last like 30 seconds of that scene when Billy and Julie come together, it's this very relatable blend of wanting something so badly, but refusing to be vulnerable to get it. And so it's these two people finally connecting, even though they're like, it's more that their passion for each other takes over rather than they are letting their true selves show. And I'm like, I get that. And like, no musical really does that anymore. Musicals now are very scared of sex and like they're willing to be sexy in a cute way, like in a Moulin Rouge way, like we're wearing fishnet stockings and heels, like aren't we cute? I'm like, yeah, but you're not really getting to the root of the human feeling about sexuality. And I think that's a moment in the show that is very powerful, and not a lot of shows get to do it, so I love it.
Well, let's move into our topic, which is Jeanine Tesori musicals. So I guess we just can just start with our connections to Jeanine Tesori and her work, and why we're excited to talk about it.
I mean, Jeanine Tesori is, in my opinion, in my very humble opinion, the best composer currently working in musical theater. She is, first of all, the versatility alone is just astounding. But also, and we'll talk about this when we get to the why is this so good section later on. Mm-hmm. That's spoiled for people. But she's her songs are also incredibly actable. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't ever really performed in a musical, you're only an objective listener, it's hard to really explain what that means. But there are some shows where it really is voice first. And, you know, if you can find a way through the vocals, then you can find acting in there. And some shows, you know, it's not even really about crafting a character or an objective. It's just about painting in bold emotional strokes. I've often said, like, I don't think Evita is a good musical. It's a thrilling musical because it's just 2 hours of pure high diva camp. But like, Patti LuPone said this herself. She's like, Eva Perón in the musical is not a well-drawn character. She is a trope that you have to then inject with like Broadway razzmatazz. And Jeanine Tesori, she could do that if she wanted to, but she's like, I would like to have, you know, humanity in there. So I love that. My intro to her, when I knew who she was Thoroughly Modern Millie, which I saw pretty soon after it opened with the original company. And that was pretty special to me. And then I went from Millie into Caroline or Change about a year or two later. And I was pretty young when I saw Caroline or Change, and I saw Light in the Piazza pretty soon after that. And that's when the whole like esoteric snob personality started. Caroline or Change, I mean, this actually could have answered an earlier question. I watched Caroline or Change and didn't know that musicals could do what that show did. Just how it plays around with reality, the fourth wall, and all the different genres just blending together. I mean, the opening sequence alone, we'll get to it because we have to talk about a lot of her stuff, but the opening sequence alone just blew my mind the first time I saw it, and it still blows my mind to this day. And that just like with each new show she does, it's always like the same narrative. The show comes out, people go, the score is just sort of okay. And then the more we get used to it, the more we're like, oh no, these songs are phenomenal. And they all become, you know, in the top echelon of modern day musical theater. And then the more I've explored her career, the more I've learned about things she's done that I never knew I loved, that I never knew were hers that I loved. Like, I don't know if you know this. She got her start on Broadway as a conductor and music arranger. And one of her big, big things in the 90s was she did the arrangements for that How to Succeed in Business that Matthew Broderick did.
Oh, right.
That Brotherhood of Man that Lilias White just annihilates in is a Jeanine Tesori arrangement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's great. And then the theater camp I went to, she used to work at, which I found out when I was a teenager.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we had this review every summer that a couple of kids got to do every year. It was called the Our Time Cabaret, and the opening was a mashup of all these show tunes that Jeanine Tesori had arranged. It was Veal Come In from Cabaret, where they stitched in Let Me Entertain You, Tradition, Starting Here, Starting Now, and you listen to it, you're like, this is an early Jeanine Tesori.
Yeah, it is so interesting to think about how she got her start, you know, arranging and working in that capacity in musical theater, and then to look at a lot of her songs and how, like, the music and the different parts, that how they're weaved in kind of like similar ways, how she's kind of thinking in that way, as she's being wearing the composer hat, I guess, as you would say.
Absolutely, yeah. What was your introduction to Jeanine?
Yeah, so I didn't see Thoroughly Modern Millie. And I actually have never seen Thoroughly Modern Millie. It's like the one show of hers that I have not seen. But I first saw one of her shows when I saw Caroline or Change. It was like the summer after I graduated college. So I was like in the city, not doing very much except going to getting lottery and rush tickets for shows. And I think I saw that twice that summer, because we saw it once and we're like, oh, we loved it. And my friends and I, and when we heard it was closing, we were like, we have to go back. I'm pretty sure we saw it twice. So that was my first Janine Tesori show. Mm-hmm. And then in grad school, she was an adjunct teacher that we had. So she was teaching a class for us called co-teaching with somebody else called the first 10 minutes. And we just like looked at the first 10 minutes of various musicals and other works, mm-hmm. to talk about, like, I guess how things start. And so she was teaching that. And all I remember, because we used to talk about this a lot when she said it, but she would talk about how chorus line is a line and Fiddler on the Roof is a circle. And those were like the opening shapes of the of the shows.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. Also, literally, the original Fiddler famously had this big turntable and chorus line famously has the line. But no, she ain't wrong. She's, for as many weird things as she's done, she actually has a very traditional viewpoint of how you structure a musical, which mm-hmm. I love, because it's, you know, the formula works. It's just a matter of like what you bring to the formula. Mm-hmm. And so people who come and be like, I'm going to break it all apart and do my own thing. I'm like, yeah, and your show can't stand it on its own 2 feet. So, and that's not me being shady. That's like just any person you've ever seen who's like, yeah, I'm going to deconstruct all of it and write it and do a whole new formula. You go see the work and you're like, yeah, you should go back to the formula.
Yeah. Yeah. So I saw that, and I guess I've seen everything she's done since.
The only thing she's done that I haven't seen was Soft Power.
Oh yeah. I did see that off Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of friends who'd seen it. I've listened to the album a couple of times, not in a long time. And then I got a good description of the plot from my guest Corey when we did, mm-hmm. we talked about it, because King and I is involved in
right
song. But yeah, I never got to see that one, unfortunately, but I've seen everything else.
Yeah I'm pretty sure I've seen everything else. Her main thing is that she works with playwrights mostly. And I feel like I think of her as like the composer who spins playwrights into lyricists. Yeah. Like that she is able to take these people who maybe have written the books to musicals but don't write lyrics, and she works with like her collaboration with them like makes these great musicals, and they become these great lyricists. I'm sure they were anyway, but through working with her, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's also very interesting because it's specific playwrights that she has mm-hmm. with who've always had like a very beautiful gift for language. And so it makes sense that they've then become these wonderful lyricists, because like Tony Kushner is a poet. So his lyrics in Caroline or Change are poetry. And then David Lindsay Abaire is a notable wordsmith. And of course his lyrics are intricate and clever as hell. So yeah, I love it. And I love that she's always sort of expanding with that way with her collaborators, because I don't know, it's a way to create something, again, structured, but have its own spin by bringing somebody in who's not normally of that world. So yeah, it's a fun blend.
Yeah, I think also I don't know with each of them like how much musical theater structure they knew going into it, but mm-hmm. I bet my guess is that she was able to take their great poetic words and really like move it into like a musical theater structure with her.
Yeah.
You know, music.
Yeah, and sometimes it's, you know, collaborations that kind of just sort of happened, not against her will, but not really with her input. Like she met David, I think, on assignment for Shrek, and then they ended up clicking. But you know, she reached out to Lisa Krohn, and she and Tony Kushner, I think Kushner, she auditioned for Kushner for Caroline or Change, because that was something he was going to make an opera, and then those are for that backed out, and then she came in, and she was like, I think this is more of an operatic musical. And he was like, okay, let's go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it totally, I mean, I think it works. It totally works.
I think it absolutely works.
Yeah.
I know a few people who saw the most recent revival and hadn't seen the show before and were very turned off.
I actually didn't see the revival. Yeah.
It wasn't my favorite. That original production is so burned in my brain. And yeah. I've always just said, like, you know, anything that George C. Wolfe has touched, it's kind of ruined for me for whoever tries to do the revival of what he's done.
Right.
And yeah, that revival, it was very odd design. It was very elaborately staged and the singing was gorgeous, but there were some choice acting performances and it didn't have the loneliness and the sadness of the original as well as the heat. So I just think we should remount George C. Wolfe's original right now and find someone.
Yeah.
$15 million and do it, please. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it was such a great production. I'm so glad that was my intro to Janine Tesori.
So like what was the most recent Tesori work for you? Like the newest would it be Kimberly or is there a show
that... I guess it was. That must have been the most recent one I saw. I saw it on Broadway last year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last year.
So I saw Kimberly Akimbo off Broadway and then on Broadway. And that's the second time that's happened to me with Tesori because I also got to see Fun Home off Broadway.
Yes.
And then on Broadway. And like Fun Home, loved it off Broadway. And I was like, I don't know how they can really make this any better. And then surprise, they did.
Yes.
And so I saw both Broadway productions quite a few times. Fun Home remains the most I've ever seen a Broadway show because I don't tend to do repeats often.
Yeah.
Usually it's like a friend is cast and I go see them and all that other stuff. It's rare that I go, no. I am seeing this specific show again because I like it so much and I don't know if I'll ever like something like this ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But Kimberly Akimbo, what I love about this score is how sweet it is.
Mm.
You know, it's not brash. And even like the big barn burner numbers like Better with Bonnie Hilligan, like they start slow and they build.
Yeah.
And that's something that Janine has even said, you know, like they wrote that song around Bonnie's voice. And she was like, we know that Bonnie can sing up to the high heavens and like easily and consistently. So she's like, I could have literally written whatever and Bonnie could have done it. She goes, but there's no fun in having her come out.
Right.
Hot. She's like, so we actually started pretty like low for her register and quiet and soft and kept sort of each verse was like a little bit bigger and a little bit louder until finally the last 90 seconds is really when she gets to wail.
Mm.
And that's just good musical theater structure. You know, the best songs are the ones that build that way. And it just helps also the lyrics are incredibly funny. So like this, like a lot of the verses in that song, it's Janine getting out of David's way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're using their first names like we're friends, but that's that's how we do in the theater. But yeah, it's her getting out of David's way because those lyrics are so smart and funny and they don't land if we're paying attention to the intricacies of her music there.
Yeah.
Music's got to let the lyrics scan. So when we get to the choruses, that's where the hook comes in and the elaborate, you know, choir.
Yeah.
Is there a song in the show that you particularly come back to?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I don't love that show, full disclosure. I had a lot of issues with it, but I do love the score to it. Like I have I listened to the score independent of like the fact that I had a lot of issues with the show itself. I do love Better. Oh, I mean, of course I love the Anagram song. Song is just super cute. And that character is just so great. I think.
Yeah, it's, I know, like, it's a very odd show and a very odd tone, and so it's, not everyone will get on board with it, which is, I don't know if that's a flaw of the show, so it's a chemical thing.
Yeah. The song, so it's interesting, the song Our Disease.
Yeah.
Also kind of, like, my issue with the show has to do with, I think it could have gone more into being a person, like being a person with a disability, incurable illness, kind of delving into that more than it did. But that's kind of why I really love the song My Disease, because
yeah,
because it's like a part where like she does have to confront the fact that, you know, she has this disease. Yeah, and
well, I think what I love about it is that, you know, for most of the show, it's been treated as this kind of like abstract thing with her. Like, it's, mm-hmm. That's just part of who Kimmy is. And like, she's a normal girl. And that breakdown she has is sort of, you know, I'm not quote unquote normal. I do have this, and it's kind of tearing me up inside that we're not acknowledging it anymore. And all these kids talk about their diseases in a scientific way, and her and Seth doing Kimberly's disease in a scientific way. Just, it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's I think it's a very believable meltdown. And I like that the turning point in the show eventually is less about like her grappling with it and more of, you know, if I'm going to continue having this, I'm going to live the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But on that end, that's also just me enjoying the sweetness of the show.
Yeah.
Entirely possible coming out of COVID and lockdown. I was like, a show that's sweet. Oh, dear.
Yeah, Lord. No, I mean, there's so much good stuff in the show that it's not like I was like anti the show there. I just had those issues. But like what I also loved with the My Disease song is that they kind of got into the fact that she was forced to talk about it. Like, they were kind of like, they push her to talk about it when she's like, I just like all of you, I should be able to talk about whatever thing I want. I shouldn't have to be like the poster child for my disease and like be forced to talk about it in front of the class with everybody.
Yeah. Seth asks her to do it because he's like, oh, you know, it's such a rare one, and you know, who better to have the information than you? And it's she's no longer a student. She's on display. She's
right.
It's like even a lyric, like, I'm a freak on display or something like that.
An incredibly rare genetic disorder in which several signs of aging are manifested at a very early age.
Some symptoms may include wrinkled skin, stiff joints, hip dislocations.
Look how they're looking at me.
Presbycusis.
Like I'm a slide, I'm a chart, I'm a freak on display.
Cardiac issues.
Exhibit A.
And it's very powerful. But I also love because it sneaks up on you because you don't think that's where the assignment's going to go.
Yeah.
Two groups, it goes relatively smoothly. And I also love that like the boys have their own sound and the girls have their own sound and like a very specific style.
Yeah.
And I mean, like when they get into like a 70s groove when they talk about scurvy, and it's just so fun. And the two girls talking about like the bacteria that one of their dads caught from eating too many vegetables or something like that, and it's like very prim and proper.
Mm-hmm.
Two harmonies. That's the other thing about a Tesori score is you're going to get some tight vocal arrangements because she does all the vocal arrangements for her shows.
Mm.
So even something as simple as Skater Planet, which is, again, just like four kids, you know, having a fun Friday night, but they have a very intricate, I think, 3 or 4 part harmony, and it doesn't assault your ears. It's just very easygoing.
But we'd rather be here skating.
Yeah, it gives me very late 90s, early 2000s vibes. It's very like bubblegum Joni Mitchell is the way I kind of describe the sound of that show a lot.
Mm.
And then there's also, of course, like the traditional Tesori recitative for something that's not necessarily like a big old song. It's like the beginning of the Make-A-Wish song, the letter she writes.
Dear Make-A-Wish Foundation of New Jersey, hello and how are you? My name is Kimberly Lovaco. Please see the attached documentation informing you of my condition and life expectancy.
You can hear sort of a bubblegum version of some of the recitative from Carolina Change, like do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I, yeah, but it's again, it's a very actable song for me. And I like how it's, I mean, it's long, it's 5 minutes, but I like in Make-A-Wish how it gets to the root at the end, and it does sort of come, not as a surprise, but you aren't expecting it to get that real so soon in the show.
Yeah.
So it's nice, and I like that it allows Kimberly her intelligence, because I think some songs will make smarter characters dumber when they sing, and dumb characters smarter when they sing, and I think that's very good about having those characters sing at the exact level of intelligence that they have in the scenes.
The mom stuff too, the Hello Darling. I think, and the reprises of that, kind of similar feel, like the she's just telling you something. It's like the songs are kind of like, I'm just talking.
Yeah. And it's very improvisational. Yeah. Like she's making the melody up on the spot. And because the mom's not a talented individual, like her melody's not terribly good.
Right.
I love that.
Hello, darling. It's me, your mother. You're in my belly right now, and sometimes you kick me. Isn't that precious? Isn't that precious? Hey, guess what? I have no hands. Just kidding.
If I have like one flaw in the score, or rather to say one song that I tend to skip a lot, it's the song that I call the Only Us song from Dear Evan Hansen between Kimberly and Seth in the hospital. It's a lovely song. And every time I've seen the show, I'm very moved. But every time I listen to it, I'm just like, I just imagine Evan Hansen and Zoe on the bed being like, and what if it's us and only us? Like, it's not that song, but still. I also cry when I see, I don't cry listening to Kimberly Kimbo, but when I'm at the show, I cry during this time, the act one finale. Again, because it's just so optimistic. And even if you don't actually know how Act 2 is going to go, you just know it's not going to go as well as they're hoping it's going to be.
Right. Yeah. So tell me about Millie, because that's like the one show of in the Tesori canon that I feel because I haven't seen it, I feel like I don't know as well.
Millie's tricky because I came into Millie not knowing it was ever a movie. I didn't know that half that score was from different places. So I just assumed like this whole original score was by her, and then eventually I did Pirates of Penzance and learned My Eyes Are Fully Open is from that, and that the lyrics are new and all these other things, and then I eventually watched the movie, and I also did the show. Millie is, in my opinion, a very fun, silly time. The problems it has, I understand. I think if people watched the original movie and then compared the show to it, it's not to like absolve the show, but rather to be like, oh, the show did do work to like make this better, because I don't know how familiar you are with the plot of Millie, but
just from a synopsis.
She's from the countryside. She comes to New York in the 1920s and she's going to be modern. She's going to marry her boss because love is for suckers. That's for the old age. And she's in a hotel for women that's run by a landlady named Mrs. Mears, who's running a white slavery operation. Any girl who comes in she realizes is an orphan with no ties to back home, she sells to China in white slavery. And she's got two cohorts in the whole thing. Now, in the show, it is a white woman in Asian drag because she's a former actress convict incognito. And she's got two Asian cohorts, Bung Fu and Ching Ho, who are only doing this so that they can get money to bring their mother in from China to America. And some people have issues with the tone of that, and the show's trying to give them dignity while also maintaining the silliness of the whole show, and that's a very difficult line to cross, and I don't know how successful it always is. But when I say, when people are like, well, they really should have tried, I'm like, they did, because the movie, Mrs. Mears is an Asian character that's just played by a white woman with no explanation. So the musical, they're like, well, let's keep that, but let's make her a racist white woman who like thinks she's like a brilliant actress in disguise. And the joke is like, she's just doing an awful stereotype and we all know better. Mm. And also in the movie, Ching Ho and Bung Fu don't have names. I'm going to say something triggering for people. If you look on IMDb or watch the movie, they are credited as, and I'm sorry to say this, Oriental 1 and Oriental 2. And this movie came out in the mid-60s when we absolutely knew better than that.
Yeah.
And they have no backstory. They're just, you know, her minions and all this stuff. So the show does try to make them people and give them grace. There's farther they could go. That said, I played one of them in high school. That wasn't fun. Or rather say, it wasn't good for me to play that role. But I will say, playing those roles, the audience loves them. The audience, they are the characters that the audience actually roots for more than Millie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like when they, because they end up like getting one over on Mrs. Mears, and Ching Ho ends up getting one of the leading ladies at the end of the show. Like, he gets to be a romantic lead, and the other one like foils Mrs. Mears. Like, they are kind of weirdly the heroes of the show. And so when we would come out, like, Millie would get a big bow because she's Millie. But like, we would come out and the audience would just go absolutely insane for us. And I was like, I shouldn't be playing this role, but I will take your applause. And yeah, the show is just like jazzy fun. And that original production was very bright and colorful and quirky. And so it holds a special place in my heart. And certain musical moments are just Broadway infectious. The Not For the Life of Me going into the title song is just like a really great 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, like one of the big songs of that show, Gimme Gimme, the big like 11 o'clock number, on a musical level, I love it. The lyrics for me are very basic, and it's just a one sentence song. Mm. Like, she's like, I think I want to be in love. And she sings that for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of songs that do things like that, where it's like, we've got one sentence and we're just going to say it 9 different ways.
Yeah.
For 3.5 minutes. So I think that was sort of Tesori and Dick Scanlon, you know, experimenting with big Broadway razzmatazz and succeeding half of the time and somewhat succeeding another part of the time and maybe not totally succeeding the other part of the time. But I mean, it's just, it's worth listening to at the very least for like the bubbliness of it.
Mm.
And Baby Sutton belting her face off.
Somebody to love.
Carolina Change. I mean, that was your first big one. So talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, I think my favorite song in that show is the Moon Change. That whole sequence, where there's like 3 different songs in there that make up like this sequence of, it's like with Dottie and Caroline, and then
on the bus stop. Yeah.
At the bus stop, and then the Moon Change, and then the bus comes in. That whole sequence is just number one favorite moment in the or string of moments in the show. I listen to that over and over again. I love that, I guess, motif. It comes out in and out of the show. In the Dottie and Caroline portion, the dun 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 dun, 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 like that. That I hardly take the bus now. I got a boyfriend. Yeah, he's got a car. Yeah.
You don't get to talk no more. Oh, God, I love it.
Listen to them frogs. Expecting the moon. I don't. hardly ever take the bus now. I got a boyfriend, he got a car. We never get to talk no more.
Knees hurt, wore out, same as yesterday, same tomorrow. Too tired to talk.
Well, how Noah
ain't
doing?
Ain't my job to mind that boy. You want to know how Noah do? Ask him yourself.
Caroline, why you huff at me? You never used to be that way. All of a sudden, so unfriendly. Ain't never done no harm to you.
I don't like the way you do. You change. Gal your age, wearing bobby socks and saddle shoes, acting like I don't know what all.
Everyone down to the college, everyone wear these shoes, and I don't see that you got called to. You the one that changed, you changed.
Last good flip hair, you's no kid and runs with mans, never mind drinking too and smoking cigarettes, and I don't know what all.
Dottie is a wonderful character. She's so smart, mm-hmm. and you know, obviously, like, she's got her hangups, but she's the only one who's ever willing to call Caroline out on any of her stuff,
mm-hmm.
outside of Caroline's daughter, Emmy, who is another amazing role. But Emmy's a child still. Even
right.
As smart and as determined as she is, she's, you know, she's so young and idealistic. The world hasn't roughened her up just enough yet for her to realize, like, the sacrifices her mother has to make in order for them to have a life and all these other things. Like, I mean, that whole Hanukkah sequence in Act 2.
Hmm. I love the Hanukkah song too. That's probably my second favorite.
it's just like Emmy going up against Rose's father, and then that same motif going up against Caroline,
mm-hmm.
with up against Rose's dad. Like, Emmy's kind of slaying, you know, she's saying a lot of amazing things, and she's, and like, it's like, that's a real conversation. And then before you can ever like get have enough time to really applaud Emmy, she's still like kind of running on fumes from that conversation and getting cut off by her mother and going back into the kitchen and using that same mentality to turn on her mother. And we're all sitting there and be like, oh no, 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 this is no, I don't like this part. Emmy, what are you doing? Stop, 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 stop.
Yeah.
But it's so good. I mean, I say it every time. Like, I don't know how anyone can listen to the first 5 minutes of Caroline or Change and not at least be intrigued.
Right.
Like the moment the washing machine turns on, And then we go from there to the radio. I'm like, how are you at least not perking up in your seat a little bit to find out what's going to happen? Because, like, musically speaking, this is just bonkers incredible.
Nothing ever happened underground in Louisiana. Cause there ain't no underground in Louisiana. There is only underwater.
Hunch, hunch, hunch,
like, it's this great, the score is just like this great mix of like things Janine Tesori does best, which is like a little pastiche of like that sound of like 50s, 60s music, which is like all over her work. And and then like this just creative musical energy of like making like of like magical things happening, like like making objects sing. Yeah,
a lot of pastiche of 60s pop rock music and blues with the dryer, and then there's also just like modern day contemporary musical sounds in there. And then when we get to the I Got Four Kids section, and first of all, you've got Noah, which is like very sweet, you know, simple melodies, like a little bit of Yiddish infused in there. And then when we get more kids, like it's almost sort of like a work song with like ties to, you know, slavery work songs in the fields.
Yeah.
And it's especially the way that Tanya Pinkin sings it, like a big wail. And the hit and turn the other cheek. And it's just so powerful. And in 10 minutes, you got like 9 different genres overlapping into each other and finishing this wonderful tapestry. And I tell people all the time, like, before Great Comet, there was Carolina Change. Like taking 9 different genres and putting them all into one song.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so much blend going on with, I mean, that's kind of like the content dictating form, you know, to quote Sondheim, but like, cause you have like all these, you have like, you know, white Jewish family, black family, Southern, and all these, but like someone, you know, people from New York coming to the South and like how that blends and like all this stuff. Yeah. There's so much going on.
Janine talked about how in an interview with Carolina Change, every now and then George C. Wolfe would look through the script with her and Tony Kushner and be like, we need some idiot space here. And she goes, what does that mean? He goes, we need 2 minutes. Audience sort of regroup and like not really think about anything so they can be prepared for the next scene.
Yeah.
So we do that sometimes. And whether that's like a 30-second punchline or whatever, it was they would always check in of like, when do we need the idiot space? And Fun Home, it's the Come to the Fun Home fake commercial.
Right.
Yeah, she's like, we're about to have Allison see her first dead body. And before we get to something like that, we need to let the audience breathe for a second and laugh.
Your uncle died. You're feeling low. You've got to bury your mama, but you don't know where to go.
Such a cute scene, and I mean, it's still doing stuff. It's not just like there for as filler or anything. It's still like, you know, like showing their characters something about like their relationship to this weird home situation that they live in, kind of thing. So it's but it's also such a funny song.
Yeah, it's very and morbid. It's a morbidly funny song.
Yeah.
And so it stays in touch with everything else. Yeah. I love how it's like the kids are just so nonchalant about death stuff until they see a body. And
right.
Yeah. It's I love it. I think it's the best musical of this century. And you can disagree with me. You're allowed to. But it's such a beautiful blend of scene and song.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the more seamless shows to do that in a long time. I don't know if you will agree with me on this. I found in a lot of musicals lately, we've kind of regressed when it comes to scene structure. Just, you know, it's very like 1920s, 1930s of like, we have a song and then we got a scene. Song and then a scene. Like,
you
flowing in and out of stuff, like not a lot of musical sequences or, you know, all these songs now have to have buttons. And I'm like, sometimes we can just sort of bleed into the next thing. Like,
musicals
are allowed to do that. And there was a time in the 70s and 80s when the creatives of musicals were like, that was their goal. Like Michael Bennett was very big on, I don't want buttons. I want something to keep going. And Les Mis famously, like not a ton of buttons, Phantom, not a ton of buttons. Yeah. Fun Home is one of the few musicals of the last 10 years for me to have that blending and then to each things. And it helps that it's a memory show, but still they didn't have to do that. It could just be like, but that, and there are buttons in a lot of songs, but there's still just a lot of wonderful sequences that just go in and out. And I love it. I love it so much.
Yeah. I want to make sure that we talk about Violet. Cause that was her.
Happy to.
That was her, you know, first musical. And it's just like a great, like way to look at like, yeah, what she was. I mean, that was her first musical that was produced. So it was a great way to like look at, you know, her early work. Yeah.
I will say as we get into Violet, because I think this is the show, the two shows that are going to get the short end of the stick today are Soft Power, just because I'm not as familiar with it. And probably, I'm assuming, Shrek. So I just want to say with Shrek, that show is fine. That score, I think, is really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that just to say it. But, you know, I know it's today is a wonderful sequence. I think I Got You Beat is secretly a phenomenal, I Think I Love You song. It builds so well. And it's also great economy because they never say, oh, we have something in common. They never say, oh, I misjudged you. It's them comparing themselves to each other. And then they do their counterpoint.
Yeah.
And then classic to story.
Yeah.
And then the only time they sing the exact same line is that my dad and mom sent me away. And then everything stops. So good. And then they do the rest of the song just like they're singing the same lyrics but with a different tone. Like, yeah. And I'm like, I love it. But also a lot of the style of the music in that show reminds me of Violet. It's got that sort of bluegrassy like the banjo pluck. That said, Violet, similar vibe, which is the bluegrass. And yes, it was her first produced musical in New York. I think it's the first musical she ever wrote. And I know it's the show that got her first Tony nomination, not because of Violet. Mm-hmm. Violet didn't go to Broadway, famously. It was supposed to, and the Times kind of killed it. But when Nicholas Heitner was directing a revival of Twelfth Night at Lincoln Center, they wanted original music and a band to play songs. And, you know, they wanted it to sort of have like a folksy feel, but it would also like have it be like touches the Middle East. And they're like, I don't know, like, who could do that? And someone slipped Nick Heitner Violet. And he's like, well, this isn't the sound I want, but like, I love these melodies. So like, I don't know, let's see if she can try it. And she did. And she got her first Tony nomination for Twelfth Night.
It's so crazy that was her first nomination. But hey, whatever gets you there.
Prince's first Tony nomination being for stage management on Wonderful Town. It's like, what was it? Okay. This was the one? Okay. But Violet, so how were you introduced to Violet?
So I had listened to it before the 2014, that was 2014, yeah, that production. So I had listened to the previous recording of it before that, but the 2014 was the first time I'd seen it.
Same.
I'd
heard about Violet a bunch. They did it at Stage Door once, and I'd seen a photo of the girl playing the role, and I was like, what's this show about? And they told me, oh, that's weird. And then I got to know some of the score over my time in college. I knew On My Way, and I knew Bring Me to Light and Lay Down Your Head, but I didn't know most of the rest of it.
Right.
And then I went to go see the 2014 revival when it transferred from Encores, and I was just pretty much floored from start to finish. Saw it two more times. It's a trend of me into story musicals. I think it's more than once. But again, like talking about a moment that just gutted me. Because I didn't know it so well, when Violet's having her breakdown in the church, because the pastor is like, I can't heal you. This is all make believe. And she's deciding she's going to heal herself. So she's having this like big breakdown and tells the pastor, like, no, you're going to stay with me as I do this. And then he starts to walk away and she drops everything and she just sings, look at me. No one will look at me.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that was coming. And my friend to this day makes fun of me because I just let out a total, the sobs just began. And they never stopped. I think she's a phenomenal character. She's in such pain, but she's also so smart. And because of the life she's led, she's had to have a thicker skin and be tough. And as an actor that's like all you want is you want a character that's got intelligence and has motivation, but like their goals are wrong in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can get behind who your character is, but not what they want. But they realize if they, I don't know. It's like the, it's having the best of both worlds, because a villain has all the wrong goals and they're fun to play, but it's like, I can't really get behind my character, but like, it's fun right. to play. And then oftentimes, as I said earlier, like a lot of heroes are just so perfect. It's easy to get behind them, but you're also like, I don't know. It's like, there are no colors here. And Violet is a character that has the wrong goals, but has all the heart and intelligence that it's like, I can get behind her as a person and get behind her journey, knowing that she's going to get
right.
knocked down a peg or two and figure things out differently. And, you know, she's sexual and she's vulnerable, but she also can dish it out. And yeah, and has some wonderful music, like has a plucky banger like On My Way, and then a beautiful ballad like Lay Down Your Head.
Mm-hmm.
And gets to have an emotional breakdown and cry and gets to be with Joshua Henry and Colin Donnell. And I'm like, I mean, who doesn't want that? It's it's the Southern scarred plucky version of Zendaya and Challengers, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I remember when I was, before I had seen it and I was just listening to it, the songs that stuck out for me were, of course, On My Way is just such a, it's just like soars. I don't know. It's just like, it's like a journey song. You're like on the train or the bus or whatever it is you're on. And it's like, we're going, you know, and it feels like that. It's so, it's just.
Yeah, it moves. It's motivating. Yeah.
And as I'm
of that score, you can feel the bus in the orchestrations, right? Like you can feel the wheels turning, you can feel the brakes turning and the gas being turned off while they like go to a bus stop. Like you just feel all of it, you hear all of it, and it's wonderful. And you can hear like the sweat on people's bodies and the bourbon that they're drinking at like hole in the wall in between trips. It's just so, it's a very visceral score, and it's a very beautiful score. It's a very poetic score.
Mm-hmm.
Those lyrics are very, not, they're not avant-garde, but like, you know, they're flowery without feeling precious, and I appreciate that. It's, I remember I had to rank the Tesori shows at one point when I did my podcast.
Yeah.
And I don't remember, I think I put Violet 3. Because Kimberly Akimbo hadn't come out yet. But even now, I think I still would put Violet above Kimberly Akimbo.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now because they trimmed it a little bit. They wrote Monty a new song, which is a better song. And they made some slight alterations and just made the whole thing move quicker, which I'm always a fan of.
Right.
It is better, shorter. And yeah, I think I have it as fun. For me, it's Fun Home, Carolina Change, Violet.
Mm.
And then Kimberly... Millie than Shrek, but if we're talking scores, then like the scores on their own, then the whole thing gets thrown out. And
right
yeah
it occurs to me actually while we're talking about that song that Jeanine Tesori is really good at writing buses. That she has maybe we'll get a third example, but in a musical in the future, but she's got the this bus is not an actual character in Violet, but it feels like it's part of the the scene. And then, of course, the bus in Carolina Change.
She should be the one that writes the Little Miss Sunshine musical, because she'll get that car singing.
Yeah, no, it's just a funny connection there. But yeah, and actually, and the very opening of this of Violet, the I forget the Love title.
Noel, like, blah, blah,
blah. Yeah, yeah. I remember when I first listened to it, that song really stuck out to me too. I mean, maybe because it's the first one, but it's yeah, it was just like a very catchy tune, I guess, that really drew me in to the show. And I guess we should say the premise of the show is that she has this huge scar on her face from an accident with an it's an axe, right? And
yeah.
And she's going to try and get healed, is what's going on. But so much else going on, you know.
I know a whole lot, but yeah. I love the lyric. I have to see the preacher about the scar that cuts a rainbow clear across my cheek. I think like that's it's so vivid and poetic, and like I don't know. You know when sometimes people try to write poetic lyrics and it's just so try hard that it makes you roll your eyes. And sometimes people just have a way with words that make you go, ah, like,
yeah. Well, in this show, I mean, another thing about this show is that you don't ever see the scar on her face. It's not, it's just not actually on the actor's face. It's, you're just supposed to, so you're just supposed to imagine that it's there. But so that really puts the onus on the words and the music to conjure the audience's experience of that scar.
Yeah, it's because when that show was on at Playwrights, it's so funny how like we all change with all the edits that were done to Violet. It was still like 90% the show that opened at Playwrights Horizons, just a little tighter. And it's so funny how like critics changed their tune on it. All it took them was like 20 years, because when it came out at Playwrights, they were all like annoyed that we didn't see Violet's scar. They're like, show me the damage. And DeSori and Crowley were like, it's not about that. Like, why are you so gung-ho to see that? It's about everything else. And you're just going to be distracted by the makeup job anyway. Like, and nothing that we show you will be as bad as you would imagine. Because when we make it literal, you'll be like, oh, that's not too bad. It's like, no, every audience member needs to imagine what kind of thing would be on her face that would make everyone act the way that they do. What's so funny is like for how dark sometimes DeSori musicals have been called or weird or cold, they all end on a relatively hopeful note or a note. Like Fun Home deals with some very difficult subject matter, but ends on a very freeing note. Like she's kind of able to give up the ghost of her dad. And part of that is also the libretto. Anyone who has read the actual graphic novel Fun Home knows that Lisa Crone gave that show a lot of heart, because Alison Bechdel is famously not an emotional person, so that book is very analytical.
Yeah,
and Crone's like, okay, but like, how did you feel about any of this, Alison? And then Violet, you know, ends on a very lovely light note, and Caroline or Change ends on the note of empowerment and hope, and Kimberly Akimbo, she is going to die eventually, but it secretly ends in this like very deceptively sweet way, which I should have called, because again, DeSori doesn't want to end on a bummer. Like, she doesn't end with Evita's corpse and Che being like, and then her body disappeared. Like, that's not how DeSori wants to end a musical.
She's
like, no, I want to give the audience something to hold on to. So for the first time I saw Kimberly Akimbo, I was like, oh no, it's going to end with her dying. It's going to end with her dying. And then it ends with her, you know, spoiler alert, going to Disney World and living the life she wants, a load of time she has. And I was so surprised. And like, it took me 6 months to go, I shouldn't have been surprised. There was no way DeSori was going to end with her dying.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing like you just have to imagine. It's like the scar. It's like you know it's going to happen. You know it's going to happen pretty soon, but it's up to you to just like imagine what that's like. We don't want to see that happen.
We're ending the story when we are to take away the message we're supposed to be taking away. Yeah. And not seeing Violet's scar is meant to no longer be important to her, so she can move on with her life, then it shouldn't be important to us to see it, you know?
Right. Should we talk about our Why Is This So Good selection, which is
nothing more.
Changing My Major.
Yeah. Okay. Changing My Major.
From Fun Home. Yeah. So why did you pick this song for Why Is This So Good?
Well, first, Shoshana was like, it could be anything. I was like, that's not what you say to me. I need limitations. I can't be told white a blank page or canvas. So I was like, let me stick this to story. And then I was thinking about what song encapsulates how I feel about Tesori as a writer. And for me, it was Changing My Major, which is an incredibly difficult song to sing and yet an incredibly easy song to act. And because it's easy to act, you can find ways into singing. What makes it hard to sing is the breath control. It's a lot of run-on sentences, and the music follows that.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of find your own way through it. But brings me back to, in the show Fun Home, if there are those who are unfamiliar, it's Medium Allison, because it's three different Allisons, and it's the Allison who's in college. And she's just come out of the closet as a lesbian and has had her first sexual experience with a girl named Joan. And it's this watershed moment for her. And I feel like it's a song that so wonderfully shows how your mind races in important moments and how you overanalyze everything. And then you zero in on the main thought, and that main thought is all you want to keep coming back to, because that's where all the happiness is. And then with the high comes the terrifying lows, and the characters in Fun Home were all incredibly intelligent, and with intelligence comes awareness, and that's a double-edged sword, because you can feel true euphoria and then you also are very aware of all the consequences.
Yeah.
And I think this song goes through all of that in a very tight, like, 4 minutes, I think. And every time I've seen it done, it has just always brought down the house. And it's not, you know, to steal a phrase from earlier, it's not a barn burner like Gimme Gimme, it's, or, you know, Let It Go. It's the biggest money note is halfway through the song, and I think it's a C, and it's just, it's for that one brief second, and then the rest of the time it remains a floaty stream of consciousness song and ends on a quiet little head voice note, and the audience goes crazy every single time. And I love that. I think that's an example of an audience losing their mind for a perfectly crafted song.
Yeah, no, it's so good. I feel like every time I hear this, I'm not generally an actor, but I'm like, I would love to sing this song. Yeah. You're just so in the moment with it. It's just so wonderful in that way, because yeah, I mean, and it's like you're in the moment with it, but still in your head, which is like generally not an in the moment place to be in your head. But they're able to make that work where it's like I'm in the moment in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. It's because it's after the fact that she's been intimate with Joan, and Joan is asleep. So she's just allowed to stay with her own thoughts. And I think it's a wonderful moment that I don't think has ever been expressed on a Broadway stage through song this way, which is like you're the first time you've had sex, and it's not, you know, an SNL sketch. It's a genuine emotional examination, and it's, you know, it's wonderful and very relatable.
What happened last night? Are you really here? Joan, 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 Joan. Hi, Joan! Don't wake up, Joan! Oh my god, last night. Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, last night.
Are there any moments in the song that you particularly like to zero in on?
That's a good question. I feel like my favorite part of the song is, well, I think it's so great that her name is Joan, because I feel like the rhymes with that name are probably my favorite part of the song. Sure. How they keep like, you know, it's gonna rhyme with Joan, but even so, it's just like every time a Joan rhyme comes in, it's just so funny to me. Because they're they're clever. They're, you don't always expect them, even though you know there's gonna be that's what they're doing in the song. They're rhyming Joan.
They also do rhymes about other stuff. Like they do the rhyme with
right.
her thighs, her eyes, ass, and her Levi's. And then yeah. rather than it just being a list song, a list song of all the ways we can rhyme Joan,
right.
they come back and forth. And it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah. They're not doing like, oh, look at this word rhyming with Joan. It's like a whole thought that ends in own that rhymes with Joan. Like, we won't need food. We'll live on sex alone. Sex with Joan, which is like alone and Joan itself isn't a funny rhyme, but like that whole thought is a funny thought.
Yeah. And that's the one that actually has the big money note in the show, in the song.
Oh, yeah.
Sex with Joan.
Foreign study to Joan's inner thighs, a seminar on Joan's ass in her Levi's, and Joan's crazy brown eyes. Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on calming down. So by the time you've woken up, I'll be cool, I'll be collected, and I'll have found some dignity. But who needs dignity? 'Cause this is so much better. I'm radiating happiness. Will you stay here with me for the rest of the semester? We won't need any food. We'll live on sex alone. Sex with Joan.
Yeah, and the lying prone on this dorm room bed with Joan. And then, of course, the final one, which is the funniest, which is, I'll do this forever. I'll take out a dementedly huge high interest loan because I'm changing my major to Joan, yeah. Which is like the save the best for last.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember each time I saw the show, watching an audience laugh at the very beginning of that song, it's already, you know, the audience is on Medium Allison's side.
Yeah.
And it's something that we can relate. And I also want to give props to Beth Malone, who, you know, she has to do a little bit of narration in between the scene and the song. And she just always would set it up so well. And then, you know, it starts quiet. And I just love the like, hi, Joan, don't wake up, Joan. Because like, she's so excited, but she's also like, just like stay asleep while I freak out right now, because you're gonna wake up and I need to pretend like I'm cool and confident.
She's yeah,
like, but now I'm freaking out, and like so the audience is already laughing at that. And then when she gets into the chorus of the I know that I'm but I must say I'm changing my major to Joan, and everyone laughs, and then she goes, I'm changing my major to sex with Joan, and
right.
everyone laughs louder. And it's just so sweet and teenagery. I love it.
Yeah.
I think, again, it's because she's so smart, and her self-awareness allows, and the way she analyzes everything and is so hyper articulate, and words, again, like words coming out 90 miles a minute, that allows us to just be on the train ride with her. And it's a gorgeous song, and that's why it's so good, I think.
I thought all my life I'd be all alone, but that was before I was lying prone with Joan. Look, she drooled on the pillow, so sweet, all sweaty and tangled up in my bed sheet, and my heart feels complete. Let's never leave this room. How about we stay here till finals? I'll go to school forever. I'll take out a dementedly huge high-interest loan. 'Cause I'm changing my major to Joan.
Well, great. Let's go to our final section, something wonderful, just something in the musical theater world that we are excited about, or something we want to give a shout out to.
I'm weirdly excited for that Nicole Scherzinger Sunset Boulevard, a musical I do not like, but everything I've seen about it is so wild that I'm like, bring it on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I take it back. I am excited for that. But what I am very excited about, is Titanic at Encores.
Yes.
with Bonnie Milligan, who we've already discussed today. Mm-hmm. That's one Tesori connection. And then another Tesori connection, Miss Judy Kuhn, I call her, also in that show. It just, I'm ready for that full-blown orchestra, that wonderful cast, and I'm ready to be flooded. It's flood all over me, Titanic. So that's what I'm shouting out for June of 2024, Titanic at Encores. And if you don't have your tickets now, get them tickets.
Yeah. No, I do have tickets. We're taking my mom for her birthday.
What about you? Is there something you're looking for?
Yeah, well, I do. I want to shout out first. The Boy Girl in Danger cast out recording came out yesterday. So I'm really excited to listen to that. Actually, I'm excited to see that I do have tickets for already is, besides Titanic, is the Bengtsons, whom I love. They are doing another show. I saw them last spring at Lincoln Center, Lincoln Center 3, doing, they do like concert style shows, and they're coming back to Lincoln Center this spring. So I have tickets for that. And I do really want to see The Wiz and Tommy still, though I don't have tickets for those yet. And I want to see Lempicka.
I see Lempicka in a week. So by the time this episode comes out, we'll have seen it. But I'm excited for that one too.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Scene to Song. You can write to scenetosong@gmail.com with a comment or question about an episode or about musical theater, or if you'd like to be a podcast guest. Love this podcast? Help it find more listeners by rating it on Apple Podcasts and leaving a review. Follow on Instagram @scenetosong. On Twitter or X @SceneSong, and on Facebook @SceneToSong with Shoshana Greenberg Podcast. Sign up for our monthly e-newsletter @scenetosong.substack.com and contribute to the Patreon @patreon.com/scenetosong, where you'll get bonus material for many of the episodes. The theme music you are hearing is by Julia Meinwald, and check back next month for our next episode.